Coming up today at 1 on Hometown Heroes, he's been married for 71 years, but during the Battle of the Bulge, he wasn't sure he'd ever see his wife again. He had to battle two enemies, the extreme weather conditions and the Germans.
I just stayed still. Shrapnel went all over me, but didn't none of it penetrate. I knew then God was with me.
Missing in action for 16 weeks, we're going to hear how he made it out alive thanks to the French underground. That's today at 1 on News Talk 580 and FM 105.9, brought to you by Humana, proud to honor our hometown heroes.
Help us help a veteran. The Farney Automotive Group in Selma is supporting the Central Valley Honor Flight. A portion of the profit from every new and used vehicle sale in the month of August will be donated to help send our local veterans on an unforgettable trip to Washington, D.C. The Central Valley chapter is chartering flights in honor of their sacrifice and service to our country. Join the Farney Automotive Group in Selma and support our veterans for one more tour with honor.
Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the show where each time we take a trip back in time and hear stories from our greatest generation. The idea is to honor our World War II veterans for their service to our country, for the sacrifices that they've made. We want to preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom still today. And along the way, there is a lot that we have to learn from these folks, often more than 90 years old, and that's the case today. Orlando Ritchie of Fresno, California, isn't going to be 93 until September. And shortly after that, hopefully, he'll be on a flight headed to Washington, D.C. with Central Valley Honor Flight. So some excitement to come, but let's go back to the excitement that was. You grew up, like a lot of veterans I meet here in California, in Oklahoma. What was it like in Oklahoma in the 1930s when you were growing up there?
Much different than it was is here now. We didn't have air conditioning, and we didn't have a lot of modern things that we enjoy now. We didn't have irrigation to raise our crops. We had to depend on the rain. Sometimes you'd get up pretty good, and then it would stop raining, so you had a bad year then, so a lot different.
Your parents separated when you were just 3 years old, so you were really raised by your grandparents. Did that seem any different to you than anything else?
No, my grandparents did a good job till I got up about 10, 11 years old, and I got out on my own because I went from here to there. I felt lost for security reasons. I had a lot of different feelings than people growing up with their parents. And I would go out and work a while and board someplace or another with people, and eventually I'd wind up back with my grandparents when they had crops to gather. Well, I'd go back and help them gather crops. And that went on until we came to California. And then I just broke ties with them and just went out on my own.
When you were 18 years old, you did something else that I guess had an impact on your life. You had no idea at that point how long you'd be wearing a uniform, but you put on your first military uniform with the Oklahoma National Guard in 1938. Why'd you do that?
Well, I wanted to earn money to buy myself some clothes. Money was real scarce back then, and work was scarce. No one had money to pay you, so you just helped each other out. So the guard paid $1.50 a night for one night at once, you know, and you got paid every 3 months. And 2 weeks summer camp in the summer, you got $1.50 a day for that time. So that was a pretty good payday then, which I served one summer camp at Fort Sam Houston, Texas. Then I got out of the guard and came to California.
And joined the Army, because I guess you liked wearing a uniform, huh? You joined the Army before America entered World War II. What was the thinking there to join the U.S. Army in 1940?
Well, I had no direction in my life, so I just knew I needed to go. So I needed to have some kind of a direction to go. So I figured the Army was the best place, and they fed me and boarded me and furnished my clothes. And they furnished my work, and I thought it's probably the worst mistake I'd made about 3 weeks after I was in there. Went through basic training, and man, I thought I was really screwed up, you know. But after that, I knew that they cared about me, and they gave me a direction in life. They took care of that pretty well.
But for a while, you didn't know if you were going to make it?
It was a while I didn't know if I was going to make it. But after a few weeks, then I began to fall into the groove, you know. I knew what was going to happen. The old-timers back there then, they come out straight out of China. Regiment had been over there for several years, and they called you and said, yeah, you're not even a human being, you know. That basic training was rough. They just dehumanized you, and pretty soon you got to thinking maybe that's right, you know. But after a while, you fell into it, and then you got to liking it. And the guys that give you a hard time turned out to be your best friends after basic training. But they really was rough on you then.
Well, and I'm curious what this did to change that dynamic, because something happened in December of 1941 that seemed to get everybody on the same page real quick. You were up in the Pacific Northwest, Fort Lewis, Washington, when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor?
Right, which Fort Lewis, Washington.
What do you remember about that? How did you find out, and what did it mean to you?
Well, it came over the radio on December the 7th, and of course, right away, well, we got busy and went on 48-hour alert, and we had to sleep in our clothes and everything, and my battalion was sent to Seattle to check out the Japanese population there, and we found that they had radios going straight to Tokyo. There's a lot of good Japanese people, too, there, but everyone was treated alike then, so they picked them up. That turned out to be a real tough job.
What'd you have to do?
Well, you had to go in and bring them out and send them back to headquarters, and they'd be interrogated there, and then going back to send them to some camps here in the States.
So just in the days following Pearl Harbor, you were rounding up Japanese Americans and sending them off to interrogation.
That's right, and many of the Japanese population was very good American citizens. I thought that should have been probably arranged a little bit differently, but our president, he felt differently about it, and he was the boss, so everyone had to do what he said, and I felt bad about rounding up a lot of good Japanese people. I thought this an injustice to the good American people that was already American citizens.
So you had some actually pretty interesting duty domestically in the States before you ever went overseas. There was another situation that you encountered. You'd been moved out here to California. You're at Camp Hunter Liggett, and there was a situation in Southern California that you guys got called in on. What was that all about?
There was a strike down at North American Aviation plant there, and they're building P-51s, fighter planes, and our president decided they'd put them back to work, so he sent their 1st Battalion, the 15th Infantry, down there to take care of that, and we landed somewhere around Ventura and got together, made our plans, and went in there 3 deep on the striking force. There was about 20,000 strikers there. Everyone was working at North America, it seemed like, everyone in California. But we broke it up as we fixed bayonets and went in on them. And a few of them was stuck a little bit in the bayonets, some blood, but no casualties. And after about 6 weeks, well, they decided they'd go ahead and build airplanes.
Can you imagine if something like that happened today, how it would be received in this country if the U.S. Army got sent in on 20,000 American workers who were striking?
I can't imagine what would happen. I don't believe that they would probably be as security interested in it as it would be then, you know. This war was fresh and everyone was patriotic, you know. I guess it'd be a lot different now, though. I'm pretty sure it would be. I don't think it'd get the Guard or the Army would be very interested in getting that done, you know.
What was that like for you? Did you come in contact with some of these strikers? Did you have to get physical with them at all, or what were your duties there?
I had to punch one in the butt with a bayonet. I'd hate to do it, but he just was going to strike me, you know, so I just stuck a bayonet in him a little bit, and then he moved out. It's kind of hard to explain exactly how you felt about it. You knew people was working too cheap, and they wanted more money, and more money was being had out there. I don't think I could do that now.
But when you signed up in the Army, you certainly didn't plan on fighting against Americans.
No, I did not. I did not figure on anything like that. You have to sign an oath that you have to defend America, whatever happens, so that's what happened.
Yeah, and eventually you would be overseas fighting a very different enemy. But in the meantime, your training continue. I understand you went back to Fort Lewis. You got promoted to corporal, and you ended up on a machine gun crew. What kind of machine gun?
Air-cooled machine gun. They made me corporal, and I had 7 men, a gunner, an assistant gunner, and 5 ammunition carriers. And I thought that was a tough job, but it really wasn't.
Well, and I'll ask you more about that, but I'm pretty sure chronologically that somewhere in here, in 1942, you had something else very important to your life happen, because it certainly has changed the last 71 years of your life. How is it that you met this teenage girl named Margaret out in Arvin, California?
We was playing out in the streets there in a little country village there, and I was batting the ball, and she was trying to catch it, and I'd say, well, you missed that one. So she had all actually caught it, but I was trying to favor her a little bit, and pretty soon while we got to talking, and then we went out on a show date there, and I actually put my hand over on her leg, and she slapped me, and I thought, well, this is the one I'm going to marry. So that's actually the way it started, and then we engagement got more serious as it moved along, and then we got married in 1942. She promised she'd meet me wherever I went, so I went to Camp Rooker, Alabama on a training cruise, training the 81st Infantry Division. That's when she came down to, we got married there then.
But you make that sound real easy, and from what I understand, it wasn't very easy, because you had to go to your boss, your company commander, and ask a little favor, right?
You had to ask permission to get married in. It was one of the rules that you had to follow. And I had to go ask him, which is a very tough thing to do. And he said, well, so let me think about it. So I was a day or two later, well, he said, well, I thought about it. Says, I decided I'd let you get married the first time you asked, but said I had to discuss it with all the officers. Says everyone in the company knew it before I did. And I got a little aggravated at him, but I said, well, you got about 2 days to make up your mind, because my wife's on the way down here, and we're going to get married whether you're okay or not.
He made you sweat a little bit.
Yeah, he made me sweat.
And, well, I guess that story of your actual wedding is interesting, too. Most people, if they've been married to someone for 71 years, they only have one anniversary, but you have two. How is that possible?
Well, she arrived by train down there about 10 o'clock in Ozark, Alabama. I borrowed my neighbor's car and went and picked her up, and we called a minister to come in and perform the wedding, and he was a little late, so we started about 5 minutes to 11 and ended up after 12. So that's the reason we have 2 dates in our anniversary. Then we got in the car, and there's a lady there that was renting from, put Margaret and I in the back seat, but she got in between us. We went to Panama Beach for a little one-night honeymoon. Got down there, and they always tried to keep us apart there for the time. And I went to, we got back to Panama Beach, but I had to go back to camp, and I didn't get back home until Wednesday night of the next week. So you had to, you got to come home once a week in the weekends if you wasn't on duty. So my bride was in a place I'd rented for $25 a month, which is almost more than I made. But then I got to see her on the Wednesday. From then on, well, it just felt like that. We fell into a pattern, you know, Wednesday and weekends. If I had duty on the weekends, I'd try to get one of my buddies to do the weekend duty for me, which worked out all right.
Well, but that routine would get shaken up a little bit when Uncle Sam decided to send you overseas, and you had been, I guess, part of the 81st Infantry Division. Then they formed a new division and put you in it?
I stayed with the 81st about 19 months, about 20 months, and they formed the 87th Division, and they picked that cadre out of the 81st, formed the 87th, and I was picked for that. There's three of us guys that went down on the original cadre from the 3rd Division to the 81st. I was picked for the 87th, and I thought, man, when is this going to end? I trained a lot of troops during that time, and you'd get them trained where they really was about halfway, could do their job, and then they'd pick them out to send them overseas. You knew they wasn't trained. You hated to send them off as, over there to get killed, you know, but you knew that's going to happen. You had no choice. They'd pick them out, and you had to stay where they went.
And you were training them specifically on machine guns?
I was trained on 60-millimeter mortars and a machine gun. 60-millimeter mortars is kind of like a artillery, only you carry it with a hand, you know, and put projectiles in it, and it goes over there, and you estimate the range and so forth.
So you're concerned about all these other guys getting sent over without sufficient training, but I guess the plus side for you was all that time gave you plenty of training for your eventual deployment.
Oh, man, I was overtrained. It was a hard job doing that. It's just repetitious, you know, repetitious. You'd get a group of troops trained, and they'd lose them, and then you'd get to start all over again. So it got to be very tiresome. I was kind of glad when they sent me overseas.
Of course, though, the reason that they sent you overseas is they had so many losses over there before you got there, right? I mean, you went over in October of 1944, so they had already made the landings at Normandy, and they'd suffered some heavy casualties. Did that weigh on your mind as you were heading overseas?
Yeah, it did, very heavily, you know. One night we went to bed, we was on the front line then, and had machine guns dug in. The weather was terrible. We was fighting two enemies over there, the weather and the enemy. And dark time came, and we got a word that was going to break through So we sat there, kept our machine gun handy, and every once in a while they did this psychology thing on us, you know, screaming and hollering and trawling for this guy and that guy, you know. So next morning, well, it got daylight again, and that guy was with me, McGee. His hair was just as white as snow. That had really psyched him out, you know, that night. He just couldn't handle it. After the next day or two, he got bushed off. He was a good gunner, good machine gunner. Things like that hurt you pretty bad. It's you're stuck with the people you go over there with, but the new ones come in while you avoid friendship, you avoid close friendship with them.
Because you don't want to have to deal with the emotions of loss?
No, it's hard to deal with that. I still have nightmares after all this time. But I guess your subconscious kicks in or something you do. There's no way to explain it.
Not to prolong that painful thought for you, but I want to touch on something you said. What color was McGee's hair to begin with?
Black. It looked like it's just laying in curls on his head, you know. Real curly and real pretty hair. Well, during the night, the black curls turned to white curls.
Because of the scare tactics?
Stress factor or scare factor. Or something, and there's metabolism in his body just turn him in that, I guess.
Wow. Yeah, I could see how that would get your attention. I want to backtrack a little bit with you, because I imagine you're a young man, I guess at this point, you're 24 years old when you're shipping out, an old man by Army standards at that time compared to some of these other guys, but you're leaving behind your young wife, not knowing if you're ever going to see her again. What was that like? How hard was that to ship out?
Real hard. I had a young son then, too. I wanted to leave something behind, you know, which was very unfair to my wife, leaving her the responsibility of a young son or a young child. And I worried some about that. But after I got over there, I went 9 months, 9 months exactly. I didn't hear a word from my wife. I thought, oh, man, dear John, you know, or something like that. And other guys was getting mail, but I wasn't getting no mail for 9 months. So that's when I sort of went goofy. Every dangerous thing come up, well, I'd volunteer for it. And that's how I got lost and behind the lines, because I volunteered too much and got careless, and just got to where I really didn't care.
Wow, that's so raw and so real, and I so appreciate your candor and your willingness to share that with us. I want to ask you again about your mindset in leaving, and you mentioned in retrospect you can see what it must have been like for her with a young son and all that, but did you believe as you left that you would see her again, or were you afraid that you never would?
I didn't know. I really didn't know. I was laying beside people, and you did, you know, and I wondered if the next one meant for me, but all I got out of it was shrapnel wounds, and the worst thing happened to me, my feet froze. There's no way you can prevent that. They say change socks every day. Well, the socks you had on was wet. You take them off and wring them out and put them in next to your body, you know, try to get them warm and halfway dry again to put them on the next day. Well, that didn't work all the time either, so my feet finally froze. And I wasn't the only one it happened to. The weather, we didn't have living conditions was terrible for the infantrymen. You had foxholes, and it was wet. You froze up during the night, and it is terrible. I can't explain exactly what it's all about.
Well, I think you're giving us a pretty good glimpse of what it was like to be in the infantry in Europe and even in the Battle of the Bulge. Before I forget, though, I want to thank the Madera Rotary Club for an unforgettable moment earlier this week when a World War II veteran named Ted Sanderson learned Madera Rotary would be sponsoring his journey to Washington, D.C. with Central Valley Honor Flight. A big mahalo to President Wren Hallett and all you generous Rotarians. If you'd like to follow their lead and help our veterans experience the World War II Memorial, find out all about that quest at cvhonorflight.org. You can sign up veterans for the trip there, and you can apply to be a guardian. We need able-bodied folks to go and push our veterans around in wheelchairs, so sign up for that too. Time right now to hear how one of our sponsors is helping that cause. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Our World War II veterans deserve a chance to see their memorial in Washington, D.C., and you can help send them there simply by renting a car. Between now and the end of October, visit any Enterprise Rent-A-Car location from Bakersfield in the south to Tulare, Visalia, Hanford, Selma, Fresno, Madera, Merced, all the way north to Sacramento. Tell them you heard this ad on Hometown Heroes, and Enterprise will donate 10% of your rental to Central Valley Honor Flight. Restrictions may apply. I'm sure you're familiar with Enterprise, but do you know why the largest car rental company in the U.S. is called Enterprise? The company's founder, Jack Taylor, was a decorated F-6F Hellcat pilot in World War II, flying off the deck of the Big E, the aircraft carrier USS Enterprise. Maybe I should get him on the show sometime and he can tell us how he earned the Distinguished Flying Cross. In the meantime, choose Enterprise for your next rental. Tell him you heard this advertisement on Hometown Heroes, and you'll be helping to send our World War II veterans on one more tour with honor.
Help us help a veteran. The Farney Automotive Group in Selma is supporting the Central Valley Honor Flight. A portion of the profit from every new and used vehicle sale in the month of August will be donated to help send our local veterans on an unforgettable trip to Washington, D.C. The Central Valley chapter is chartering flights in honor of their sacrifice and service to our country. Join the Farney Automotive Group in Selma and support our veterans for one more tour with honor.
On the front line of freedom, you are listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guests today are Landa Ritchie, 92 years old, almost 93. Originally from Bartlesville, Oklahoma, he's been in the same home in the Tarpe area, right on the border between Fresno and Clovis, for over 60 years. He wouldn't be there without surviving some seriously scary situations during World War II with the 87th Infantry Division. When we left off, he had mentioned fighting two enemies in the Battle of the Bulge, the Germans, of course, and the extreme frigid weather. I'm curious what helped you get through to the next day when you're in that freezing foxhole and it's cold and wet and you can't feel your feet or you're in pain, you're scared about what's going to happen the next day. How did you find a way to sleep? What was it that you think helped you survive and endure?
I think my trust in God helped me more than anything else. I got closer to God at that time than I've ever been in my life. It seemed like I just asking for him to save me and bring me home, and I guess prayers do get answered. So I felt that that's what happened to me. I never felt desolate. I never stopped asking God to save me, and I had a lot of training. I fell back on a lot of that, you know.
A lot of veterans have told me if they were married at the time or engaged, they would take a photo of their bride or their fiance. Did you have a photo of your wife and son with you all the time?
I didn't have it all the time. It's always in my duffel bag or barracks bag, they call them in. When I went in the hospital with frozen feet, I got my duffel bag and my stuff. I had a musette bag, and I had quite a few souvenirs in there that I wanted to get home, and they said, you'll get it back. Well, I knew I wasn't going to get that bag back with them souvenirs, P-51s and cameras. Film hadn't been developed, and he picked that up off your dead soldiers, you know, the Germans. And mostly he was looking for cognac and bread, black bread and cognac. Tried to get to the officers, because they carried good brand cognac, and they had the best weapons. You know, actually, though, I never was really mad at the enemy. I never was really mad at them. I knew that they was just doing what I was doing. They was trying to kill us, and we was trying to kill them. So I never really got mad at them. That's a strange thing that most people wouldn't believe that, but I never really got angry at them. I just tried to do my best to serve my country and to stay alive.
Well, and I know there's a lot of people that are glad you did. You talk about not being mad at the enemy, and I guess I have to say, even when they fired those infamous 88s at you, do you remember the first time you encountered that German artillery?
They introduced us to about 5 minutes worth of 88s when we first went into bivouac on the front line, and it was terrible. You know, he didn't know where to go, and they'd fall in among you. We had some casualties. He didn't know whether to move or whether to stay still or what, because if you moved, the next round might fall right where you're going to move, you know. So I just stayed still. Shrapnel went all over me, but didn't none of it penetrate. I knew then God was with me. It scares you. It shakes you up, and morale goes rock bottom, you know. Our first casualty was company commander. Always had a person with him. They was up in front observing the enemy line, and he turned around, and someone had caught Gruder right in the head, you know, and just busted him all up. And he put his hand in that, and he went berserk. We had to take him out of the line on more or less like and tied him up, took him off the line. I never heard from him again. And he is a West Pointer.
That kind of backs up the statement so many veterans have shared with me, that nothing, as much as you prepared before you went over, nothing can really prepare you for what you're going to deal with.
Can't compare yourself with that. You just, our ammunition carrier was laying back down. If you want to get him up to get him moving, thought he was just scared, you know. I went up and kicked him in the butt, and he turned him over, and he was deader than a bone. So that sort of shook me up, you know. But after a while, you get sort of used to it, sort of used to it. There's nothing in the book that will tell you about dead people or people getting killed. So I don't like to even think about things like that.
I don't blame you. And it wasn't just the people that you saw devastated. Here, some of the places where you fought, cities like Metz and Koblenz, these great historic cities where so much had been built over the years, so much that the people could have been proud of, and you saw them pretty much destroyed, huh?
Yeah, it was destroyed. Koblenz, that's what you're talking about. 87th Division captured that town and held it, and that was costly, very costly, in troops' lives. But we held in there and got it. Some of the German people, they helped us, showed us where to go, you know, and this and that. There's all them people over there wasn't Hitlerized. There were some of them real good people.
Koblenz is actually the city where my great-grandmother came from. So you're saying that the German civilians there in that city, as you're fighting the German army, the Wehrmacht, for this city, the German civilians were helping you, giving you pointers and telling you how you could defeat the enemy.
Right, there was. There's very good people in that town. There's a lot of fanatics, but there's a lot of real good people. My grandmother was born in Germany, incidentally. She raised 7 kids, and none of her children knew that she could speak German. And when we came along, well, she was a tired old woman. She'd get mad at us, me and my sister. She'd get mad at us, and she'd spit that German out at us, you know. And I'd tell her own children that, and they wouldn't believe that. And I said, don't matter to me.
Well, the question is, did you remember any of it? Did it come in handy when you were interacting with German-speaking people?
Some of it did, and most of it just went over my head, you know. I was uneducated, and most of it just slipped by. But I learned a few words when I got over there.
You talked about Koblenz, the huge cost there, the price in human life. And I guess I have to ask, how close did you come to being part of that? I imagine that you were pretty close to some of that heavy action. Do you remember some moments where it was almost your number that was called?
Yeah, I remember two times that see people right beside you get it, you know, and they say, man, the next one's mine. So you just kind of go out of your mind, you know. Well, if it is, it is, you know. So life was so damn miserable over there, excuse my language, but you get so miserable sometimes you just really don't care. Night's not going to be no relief to you, just another wet foxhole.
Well, and maybe that's important to note, too, for people who aren't familiar with how brutal the weather was during the Battle of the Bulge specifically. How did you stay warm? What did you have? Did you have anything on you that could help you stay warm through the night, or were you pretty much perpetually frozen?
No, we had a heavy overcoat. It got about half wet. There was some warmth in it. Even though it was sort of damp, you know, there's some warmth in it. That was about the only thing we had. And it covered your whole body. You kind of snuggled down in it. And it come your time to stay awake. Well, it's hard to stay awake. It gets so cold, you'd chatter and shake till you warmed up, and then you'd doze off. And then you'd get cold again and start chattering again, you know, shaking all over. And then you'd warm up a little bit. But that's the way a lot of us kept you from freezing to death.
Well, and I know we've got a lot more ground to cover, but you mentioned earlier the frozen feet. For some reason, I have a feeling that that's something that you've had to carry with you for 70 years here. I mean, that's not something you left over there in Europe. Is it something that still bothers you? Are there some effects of that are still with you?
It still bothers my feet. Sometimes they hurt. Sometimes they feel all right. When I get tired, my feet hurt too, you know. And I don't know if that's a cause of frozen, but I kind of believed it was, because I didn't do that before. Yeah, they still bother me.
You mentioned how there were times you'd see someone hit next to you and you thought, the next one's mine. And then that happened. You were hit with some shrapnel. You were wounded. You ended up being listed as missing in action. How did all that unfold?
I was on a patrol. We run into a big patrol from Germany, and they was just outdoing us, so we just split up. Everyone was on their own. Me and one other guy made it back. I always felt guilty that the guys that maybe I could have done something to help them to got back too, you know, but situation like that, while you're thinking about number one.
How many guys were on this patrol?
There was 8 of us.
And when the Germans outnumbered you, you split up so you wouldn't just be executed by them.
Yeah, we split up and went different directions. And later on, we tried to regroup. Me and another guy tried to regroup, and we found a lot of others was dead, you know. It's just a terrible feeling.
I want to make sure I get the whole story on this. You alluded to this earlier, and you said the reason this happened was because you volunteered for a task. This was something they were looking for volunteers to go out on this patrol and figure out where the Germans were, or what?
Yeah, they send you out on reconnaissance patrol for going in on the edge of a group of Germans' campsite. You can go there and figure out the morale, how they're eating. And just listen to them, you know, there's always one or two German-speaking people that will understand. Then you take that back to the S2, and he'll put it all together and figure out what's up ahead, what the morale is of the German people, you know, the one that you went up and picked up the information. Sometimes you pick up a prisoner or two, you know.
So this wasn't the only time you did something like this?
After I couldn't hear from my wife, I didn't care. I'd volunteer for everything. I went on a lot of patrols.
It almost sounds like you were trying to get yourself killed.
Yeah, I didn't have no will to live. There's another little incident tied to that 9 months of no letters. I got to Camp Carson, Colorado, rehabilitating there, and I got the whole big box of mail. I found out my wife had wrote me every day, and I went to go into them, and I told her to be sure and send a safety razor blade in each letter, you know. So we needed to shave, you know, and Patton, he's hell on you staying clean, you know.
Yeah.
So I had all them razor blades. Most of them had rusted because that mail had been following me around, but we were just moving too damn fast, or I was, and some of the others was getting mail. But some coincidence, I just didn't get mail. I got it all at Camp Carson, Colorado.
And she got some mail that said you were missing in action, so that had to be tough for her. But how long was it after you went out on that patrol in the middle of the night, got separated from the rest of the guys, and had to just try to survive? How long did you spend away from your company?
Stayed away about 16 weeks, and all getting back, I finally could run into a friendly company, and I soldiered with them a little while, about 2 weeks. Out of that 16, I soldiered them about 2 weeks, and we got close to my old company. Well, then I could go back to my original company, which they didn't want me to go on back to the company then, but I want to get back to my real company, you know.
But that was not an easy journey. Tell me about it. Where was this, where you had to split off and fend for your own?
Well, it's somewhere there in eastern Germany. I don't know the names of the towns or anything, but it's in eastern Germany, and we was being hit pretty hard, and they wanted to get information about the troops, whether it's SS troops or whether it's just put-together troops or there's new troops or what. So that's how I come me on that patrol to find out. And just got up there and run into a big patrol coming after us, you know.
And is this where you were wounded?
No, I picked up some shrapnel from my bullet wounds, but I didn't. My legs was, I had nicks in my legs and my arm. You had first aids on your pouch, and they were pretty well fixed up, and it wasn't real bad. But I just pulled out your first aid pack and had your buddy or whoever it was, or maybe you could do it yourself, wrap it around, pack it in sulfur, and it wasn't real bad. You just didn't have to go back to hospital, and you didn't even have to turn it in.
So you go through this encounter with the German forces. You're hit a little bit. You're not in extreme pain, and you're not debilitated, but you're on the run. I mean, this is a pretty desperate thing, just you and one other guy, and you don't know where's where and who's who.
No, I was by myself. I wasn't with another guy. The other guy, he finally got bumped off. The other guy that escaped that night, you know, he finally got bumped off. And the reason I found out about that when I got back to the company was someone had located him and sent it back to the company. They have what they call a morning report. So-and-so was missed in action. So-and-so was killed in action, you know. So they found out that he had been killed in action.
So you are all alone, and you don't know where the Americans are, where the Germans are, who can help you, who won't. How did you find that help? How did you get out of that situation 16 weeks later?
Roamed around in the woods there and tried to stay hid in the daytime, and pretty soon my wife run across the French underground, and they spoke a little English, and they said, "We're here to help you." And I didn't know. I was very suspicious of that, you know. But pretty soon, well, they gained my confidence and gave me something to eat. I eat everything always by myself.
Well, that was going to be one of my questions. I mean, when you're on your own in the woods, no one's serving you breakfast.
Well, I eat a lot of berries, of frozen berries, and anything looked like it would be good to eat, I tried it. I was really getting pretty hungry at the time. I think it was about 4 days after I was by myself till this underground person found me, and we talked a little bit, and he had some canned food on him. So we had a little meal of that, and after that, well, they took care of me. And,
And how'd they get you out of there? How'd they get you back to American control?
We moved by night and hide in the daytime. We was in a very thick concentration of German troops in there. They'd take me out and hide me in the daytime. They'd hide me in cellars. They'd cover me with old blankets and Lord knows whatever. And then at night, while we'd move out, and I got pretty ragged after a little while. But I eat all kind of German food. I eat all kind of French food. And actually, it's pretty good food. But I was hungry, and everything tasted good. That brings up another story. There's one night, we moved three times that night, and was in a kind of a cellar-like thing, if you will, a kind of a basement type. And they had a little hut down in there that they could hide and cover with blankets. So the Germans got wise of that, and they sent four people down there to investigate that thing from future actions, you know, of it. So they come down there, and I'm in this hut, you know.
And we're going to leave you in there for a minute because it's break time again. 92-year-old Arlanda Ritchie, our guest today. We'll find out how that tense situation unfolded when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. The average age of the veterans on this program is pretty close to 90, so I've seen firsthand over the years the challenges of aging, and I've realized that everybody approaches them a little differently. For some, a friendly senior living community is the ideal option, but for many of us, there's no place like home. I don't have any ruby slippers for you, but I do have an idea. Call Jason Selsler at 317 Construction, recognized by the National Association of Home Builders as a certified age-in-place specialist. Instead of giving up the comforts of home, why not let 317 Construction make your home more comfortable by making it more accessible? Jason and his crew can widen doorways, install ramps for wheelchairs or scooters, reconfigure your counters for better access, modify your shower for safety, secure grab bars wherever you need them, whatever it takes to allow you and your family to keep making your memories in the place that holds so many of them, your home sweet home. Call 905-8490. That's 559-905-8490. A high school where 98% of graduating seniors go to college, where success on the SAT and advanced placement or AP classes outpaces almost every other school in the valley. Home to a student newspaper that hauls in national awards on an annual basis. Its sports teams capture section championships. Have you figured it out yet? The school is Fresno Christian, and it's not just a high school. Fresno Christian offers a complete K-12 curriculum delivered by supremely qualified, experienced teachers who connect with their students personally, intellectually, and spiritually. Go to FresnoChristian.com to learn more about the value of a truly Christ-centered education. And if you want to see for yourself, call 299-1695 to schedule a campus visit. Whether it's kindergarten, high school, or anywhere in between, you'll get a genuine feel for what Fresno Christian's commitment to excellence could mean for your student. That number again, 559-299-1695. Fresno Christian Schools, education with a higher purpose.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, getting Arlanda Ritchie's story today. He served in the 87th Infantry Division in Europe in World War II. We've heard about how a patrol he had volunteered for was overrun by German forces, how he and his fellow soldiers split up, and how he survived all alone until help arrived from the French underground. The 16 weeks he spent missing in action had him hiding quite a bit. And we left off with this young soldier who had a wife and son back home, hiding under a bunch of blankets in the basement as four German soldiers came down the stairs.
And pretty soon, it's all quiet, and I thought, and I could hear them talking. I said, well, these guys are going to kill me if I don't do something. And it turned out to be that they were all untrained troops of officers, to say, protected people. And they had absolutely no training at all. They was carrying swords and all their for novelties, you know. So I decided that's going to kill me. If they found me, they're sure going to kill me, even if they had any training or not. So I got out of that troop, and I got around the corner of that hut. One of them come around, I gave him a karate chop and put him out of action and kicked him in the head. And then I kept on. I got all four of them down, and I actually felt that I had murdered four people. I actually felt that. It bore on my conscience, still bears there, that I had murdered them four people. But, you know, that's what they was going to do to me. So I got back, and that's when the French underground didn't come along. As they was a little ways down the road, they had someone else with them, another guy, and they picked me up And we moved three times that night, and he was going a different direction, so two of them took him and went a different way. And his people that wanted to get back to my company, they took me a different direction there.
I can't imagine how tense every single one of those days must have been to constantly live in fear of being discovered, of being captured, of who knows, of, like you said, of being killed. Looking back on it now, what do you think it was that got you through that?
God. I prayed every time I got a chance. God, get me through this. And I believed he would.
I guess that's maybe something the rest of us could take a clue from. When you're constantly hiding somewhere, hoping no one sees you, not moving a muscle, gives you a lot of time to pray, huh?
It's real tough. You're afraid to move. You're afraid to do anything. You think maybe I was, Jesus, sometimes I wanted to cough, and I just control that, you know. Oh, man, it's hard.
This is probably a really hard question to answer, but over those 16 weeks, how many different people, French, German, or otherwise, do you think risked their lives to help save yours?
I've often thought about that. I really don't know, but it's very dedicated to what they were doing. They understood what the situation was with me, and I failed to understand exactly what they was going through then. But after I got back to the company and the war was over, I thought, man, I don't know how many people they lost in that, you know. The Germans was no dummy people. The only time you figure that you're smarter than the enemy, you're getting in trouble. You figure the enemy's smarter than you are, and you might get out of that thing alive, but you figure that you're smarter than they are, you don't do that, because they're smart people. They're very good people. They just got led by the wrong man.
You mentioned that one escape that you had to make with the four Germans that were looking for you down there. Were there any other moments like that in that 16 weeks where you came really close to being caught?
No, that's the closest. But several times we moved out just ahead of them because they'd tell me they're coming right behind us, you know, they're a mile or two back there. They did constantly searching for prisoners, you know. Like I say, I trusted in God. God helped me out here.
So what did it feel like when you finally saw American uniforms again and got to speak Okie English to some guys from back home in the good old USA?
Oh, God, I can't explain how thrilled I was to be back home and be back. I actually felt like I was back home with my own people, you know. It's just a great feeling. The old mess sergeant there, we went into the camp. He had a big pot of coffee, and Lord mercy, I was a coffee drinker. He said, just sit down there and have all the coffee you want.
I imagine, too, they wanted to know what you'd been through. They probably had a little debriefing session with you, right?
Yeah, they had a session with me. I told them as much as I could to attend. I was very thin. I'd been lost a lot of weight. My nerves was on edge. I couldn't hardly get around, you know. It bothered me.
And this was pretty close to the end of the war by then?
Yeah, it was getting pretty close. When they took me to Camp Garson to rehab, I'd got back on my feet pretty good, and I could hobble around. And this figuring on a big raid on Tokyo. So the company commander there called me in the orderly room one day, and he says, we're going to send you on a 30-day furlough home. That's what we think you can make it. He says, at the end of that 30 days, then we're going to put you on orders to go to the South Pacific. And I said, I've already been to war. He said, well, they're going to send you. You're needed over there. I said, why am I needed when there's 100,000 other people here that could go too that hadn't been on the front? He said, well, your MOS says you're needed over there. That MOS is military occupational specialty. And I was good at weapons and training people in weapons. So. But while I was home, they dropped that bomb on Hiroshima, I think it was.
Saved your life, huh?
Saved my life. I wouldn't be here talking to you if that bomb had them out. And that's another thing. I think the bomb was good, but it set the whole world in an explosion's action. Everyone wanted the bomb then.
A couple more things I want to ask you about, and you mentioned realizing that your wife had sent all those letters after all, and I can't imagine what a revelation that was at the time, but I imagine it paled in comparison to actually seeing her again and seeing a son who had grown a little bit. What do you remember about that moment, being reunited with your wife and son?
I felt like, you know, that she'd left me for somebody else, which I really couldn't blame her. I got back to the hospital there in Staten Island. They asked me, did I want to send a telegram to my wife? I said, I don't have a wife. Well, it says on your service record you got a wife. That's what my service record says. What I'm telling you, I don't have a wife. So they went ahead and got in the service record and got my home address and sent her a wire. And then she mailed one back to me, and I just didn't know what to do. you know, she didn't explain. And I drove her every time I had a chance, I'd ride her, you know. So finally, she got to come out, talk to her, and I felt so odd, you know. I felt like I was talking to someone strange, you know. I didn't know what it went on in between, you know. She says, I've been with no other man. I says, well, only you know that. Only you know that. I wanted to make it easier for her. And it turned out she hadn't been. It put trust back into her marriage. And it's just one of those misfortune things that happened. I felt guilt and I felt happy. And gosh, I just don't know. I can't explain exactly how I did feel it.
Well, and you mentioned where you were was the hospital. That tells me that you weren't in the best of shape. What kind of physical challenges were you facing?
Well, my feet was absolutely bad. My teeth was bad. They pulled the teeth, got false teeth, and they got my feet patched up pretty good, so as good as they could, you know. That was what I was back there for at Camp Carson. We had people all over that had frozen feet. A lot of them lost toes, lost feet, whole feet, you know. I was lucky I didn't lose no toes or nothing, but it still bothers me. That's why I was in the hospital there. I never went back to the hospital for any wounds, bullet wounds or anything like that, but the shrapnel in my shoulders and arms didn't bother me a whole lot. I just, you know, he'd been scratched up pretty good, but they hadn't gone real deep. This arm here still has shrapnel in it.
Your right arm up by your shoulder?
Right in there. They got the most of it out, but that one piece is in there so close to the nerve that they're afraid to bother it. If they just touch that nerve hardly, I'd lose my right arm, you know, lose the use of my right arm. But they said, just leave it go if you don't want to take a chance of losing your arm. I said, I'd rather have that there than to lose the chance of me losing my right arm. I still got it in there, but...
You know, it's very clear from everything that you've shared with us. And we talk about veterans and their service and their sacrifice. And I think the sacrifice part of that has been made very clear through this interview. The sacrifices that you made over there, the things that you went through physically and emotionally, mentally. Was it all worth it? Was what you did over there worth the price that you've paid for these last 70 years?
Yeah, I'd do it again.
Why?
I don't know. Just... patriotic to my country. I believe in my country and I believe in my flag. I believe in freedom, and I saw how people was handicapped over there by a ruler of one man, you know, a fanatic man, and what their fears was of him. And I thought, well, we don't have that at home. And it's what I'm doing here now is worth what I had to do, you know. And I guess if I was called on again, well, I'd probably do the same thing. But one thing when you're in the combat, though, patriotism goes out the window. You fight to save yourself. To save yourself. That's your main priority.
Well, it's a good thing you were able to save yourself, or that you were able to be saved, because you had a couple more kids that wouldn't have been born. You got some grandkids and great-grandkids that wouldn't be here either. And I wouldn't have had the pleasure of this interview with you today, so I'm thankful for that. And I want to ask you also about Honor Flight, because you are signed up to go to Washington, D.C. with other World War II veterans to see the World War II Memorial, a memorial that recognizes what you did and pays special honor to the 400,000 Americans who didn't get to come home from World War II. Why do you want to go? What do you hope it means to you?
Well, I want to see my name put on that memorial nationally. That's the first priority. And the next thing I'd like to have time to go over that memorial a little bit and see names of people that might be lost, that were my good friends, and if they did get lost, if they was killed in action. I don't know what the memorial will tell me except names. I don't know if it'll explain anything other than that, but I want to go see.
Yeah, you know, if you aren't familiar with the World War II Memorial, in addition to the sections for different theaters of the war and the names of every state, of course, that centerpiece fountain with the wall of gold stars marking the price of freedom, on the perimeter of the memorial is a kiosk where you can pull up a digital registry of World War II veterans. In fact, if you want, you can access that online right where you are and even submit the name and information of the veteran in your life. Speaking of names, Mr. Ritchie, you also interacted with two of the most famous names in terms of American generals in World War II. That even includes a future U.S. president. What's the story there?
Eisenhower was a major at Fort Lewis, had the 1st Battalion of the 15th Infantry when I went in. He was a very good commander. He was a very tough commander. He always wore white gloves, and on Saturday morning, if he run his finger down your chamber of your rifle and it comes out a little bit soiled, you stayed home that weekend. You didn't go to town. So you took special interest in that particular spot of your rifle. He was a major then, and then he left there and went to war college, and the next thing I heard from him is in North Africa. Yeah, I've met him, and Patton came around one morning there. It was really cold that night, kind of a dry cold, but yet there was moisture in the air in the foxhole, you know. And your machine gun, if you didn't work it once in a while, why, it would freeze up, you know. So you had to keep working that about every 5 minutes, you know, or to keep it loosened up. He used to come by and was working that machine gun. He says, "You better oil that son of a that you're going to need it in a little while." Every other word was him, but a cuss word, you know. Looked up and he's sitting up there in dry clothes, you know, the war boots on and a big fur collar. And I thought, "Oh, why don't you go back where you came from?" But he was a frontline soldier. He always says he kept himself comfortable, though, which is normal. You know, he's a commander.
You didn't ask him for his pearl pistol, huh?
No. I didn't really look to see if he had them on or not. I was kind of aggravated at him. I looked up and saw him up there in a nice fur coat, you know, and I'm down there freezing. My feet froze. I'm cold all over, and he's up there in the fur clothes, and I just thought, "Well, who the hell are you?" You know.
Well, that goes, they call them old blood and guts, and sounds like you were among the camp that said, our blood, his guts?
Yeah, our blood and his guts. He was a good commander, though. He is a feared commander.
History certainly reflects that. Well, I want to give you a chance to share anything else that you think we ought to know, but I also want to know, you've been very open about how you felt about things with your wife early on and all that. Now you've been married 71 years. You must be doing something right. What do you think's the secret to your long-lasting marriage?
Communication is the main thing. If you got communication with your spouse, most everything else will fall in place. Oh, we have tough times, too. I mean, we have arguments and things that don't go right sometimes, but that's normal. This is normal as life. But the main thing is communication. If you lose that, well, you lose a lot in your marriage. She's always been honest with me, and I've tried to be honest with her.
It sounds simple.
It sounds simple. It's not easy to do, though. And there's got to be love involved, too. You got to love her. She's got to love you.
Well, I guess in closing, I should ask you, what are you most proud of, and what are you most thankful for?
Well, what I'm most proud of is my family. And we've had a lot of longevity in our marriage, which I'm thankful for, too. And sometimes it gets a little rocky on the first 25 years, it gets real rocky, you know.
I'm only halfway to 25. Thanks a lot.
Yeah. Really, communication is the main ingredient that I think is important.
Well, I'm going to keep working on that. And I'm so glad that you communicated with us so candidly today. Thank you for serving our country. Thank you for having the courage to share your story. And I hope that trip with Honor Flight in October is the experience of a lifetime for you. That is Arlanda Ritchie. You'll find some great photos of him on Facebook. Just pull up Hometown Heroes Radio. And, of course, tune in again next time when I take you out to California's Central Coast in a conversation with a combat engineer who spent a lot of his time clearing minefields. That's not a dangerous job or anything, right? If you're free next weekend and you want to see some great examples of World War II aircraft, head to Atwater and Castle Air Museum for Open Cockpit Day, Sunday, September 1st. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free. If you are a World War II veteran and you have not been to the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C., Honor Flight wants to take you there, free of charge. The sooner you submit an application, the sooner Honor Flight can get you to your memorial. In Kern County or the Central Coast, call Lily Marsh at 661-544-VETS. That's 661-544-VETS. Or go to honorflightkerncounty.org. For Fresno, Madera, Merced, Mariposa, Kings, or Tulare counties, check out CV Honor Flight, CV as in Central Valley, CVHonorFlight.org, or call Al Perry at 559-970-9853. That's 559-970-9853. Maybe you're the son or daughter of a veteran and you'd like to go along as a guardian. There are applications for that too, and there are other ways you can help. Donations to Honor Flight are tax deductible. We all owe our freedom and liberty to the men and women who put their lives on the line for it. Let's all come together now behind Honor Flight and give our veterans one more tour with honor.
I was working for a guy in that 14 years there that I wasn't in the Army, in the Guard. building a house and framing. And he got kind of friend of him, and he come around one day and he says, "Well, Rich, getting close to a little old election time, I think it was." And he said, "Since I am making a lot more money than you are, said, don't you think that I should have about 10 votes to your one?" I said, "Well, you SOB. What do you think? I froze myself to death over and laid my life on the line to stop that kind of crap." I said, "Wouldn't be long, you'd be like Hitler." And he moved on. I said, "Well, I know you're going right up my time, so it's nice working for you, but I don't agree with you." And he said, "I'm not going to write you this time up. So come out to work in the morning." I worked for him for two or three more houses, and I got another job. I never did respect him after that, though. I never did respect him.